All right, you guys. Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Yeah. All right. Cool. Guess what? Doug Bandow's going to be on the show today to talk about Asia issues with us. Boy, we're not going to have enough time to talk about all these different articles. I've got four different Bandow articles here to talk about. And only one segment to talk about them with him. But anyway, we'll do what we can. Also, Daniel Larrison is going to be here to talk about the war in Yemen. He's got a great piece. One of the best Larrison pieces he's written in a while. It's Who's War in Yemen? At the American Conservative magazine. And you'll want to hear that. And you know, it's funny. I think got a couple more invites out. We still may hear back from somebody, but I guess we'll see. Boy, that's a weird looking picture of me. Am I really that weird looking? I don't know. I guess I am. Men cannot be trusted with guns. That's why everyone should have them. Where did they get that quote from? I did say that. That's on a bumper sticker of mine, actually. I wonder if that's where they got that from. Anyway. That's a good quote, isn't it? In fact, I think Rick McGinnis did a different one, which said, men cannot be trusted with guns. That's why every woman should have one. Ah, touche. All right, so, yeah, anyway. Better write up a blog entry here. I know I'm supposed to do this before the show, not in the first segment. Oh, also, I need to join up the chat room. Check out the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat. If you like chatting with folk about things during things, well, there are people in there, and this is a show, and so there you go. Hey, guys. Good to see you. ScottHorton.org/chat. Also, it's an IRC Freenode chat room. Hashtag Scott Horton Show, if you prefer to do it with an external chat type application. Oh, yeah. And I know it never matters. I always apologize up front for noise outside, and then you guys end up never hearing it anyway. But there are literally men with chainsaws and jackhammers next door. And by next door, I mean this house has a 1-foot property line. So, kind of the other side of the house, but not really. Anyway, you may hear some chainsaws and some jackhammers as they're pulling up some tree roots. Tree stumps, I should say, next door. But hopefully it won't be too bad. Today's show, Daniel Larrison and Doug Bandow. Yay. 12 to 2 Eastern. Yeah, man. Tonight on Liberty.me, a brand new show, not Eye on the Empire with Jeff Tucker, a brand new show, The Future of Freedom, hosted by me with a weekly regular guest, Jacob Hornberger. So it's going to be kind of different. It's not going to be like co-host situations like it is with me and Tucker, where we're more or less just talking and taking turns asking each other questions and stuff. This is going to be more like just me interviewing Hornberger for half an hour. And I thought that was best because you guys are sick and tired of hearing what I got to say anyway. Hornberger certainly heard it all. I get to have my say here on this show and on Eye on the Empire. And on the other hand, Jacob Hornberger writes 4 or 5 times a week. I mean, he has an essay a day there at FFF.org. And so it seemed to me like a pretty good bet that what we do, especially if it's just going to be a half-hour show, which it is, we should just focus on what he's writing. And so I'm going to have to do some double-checking after the show to make sure, but so far that means today's show is going to be about immigration and guns. Immigration and guns. Tonight on The Future of Freedom, the new streaming video show, at liberty.me. Just go to liberty.me and click the blue button that says live, and you will find the link That's tonight at 8 Eastern time, 7 Texas time, at liberty.me. The Future of Freedom with myself and Jacob Hornberg. All right, cool. And then let's see what time is it. Oh, it's still got a minute. I thought this was funny, man. This morning, I kind of slipped in a little bit. I should have had two coffees instead of just the one. I was looking at my Twitter mentions this morning, and a guy got into a fight with a guy about American support for the jihad in Syria. And he cited my interview of Brad Hopp, and he's arguing with some, I mean, he should have quit arguing probably a long time ago by this point, because it was clear that the guy he was arguing was just some, you know, Likudnik troll, basically. Anyway, what it came down to was, he cited me, and the guy said, oh yeah, right, like I'm going to listen to a truther white supremacist. And I thought, that's funny. I don't think I've ever been called that before. I don't know if anybody's ever called me a truther before, since virtually every day I make the point on this show that America provoked, that Bill Clinton and his policies provoked the September 11th attacks, and for that matter, the coal and the LAX plot and the Africa embassies and the Khobar Towers and the UN Lincoln and Holland Tunnel plot and the World Trade Center, the first World Trade Center. Oh, I left off Bojinka in there, the failed Bojinka plot. All of that going back to 1989, really, in the United States, Egyptian Islamic Jihad and the Azzam group and what eventually became Al-Qaeda in their war against us has been provoked by Israeli and American foreign policy this whole time. When I criticize the Americans, the Israelis, the Turks, the Saudis for supporting the al-Nusra Front, I make the point that that's high treason because they are sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. So how the hell does that make me a truther? And a white supremacist? I mean, come on, this is just lazy. If anyone has ever heard this show and what they learned from it was white supremacy, then, well, you're lost in the dark. But hey, you know what? I guess if I was arguing for Israel, I'd have to make up a bunch of crap too, since the truth is very anti-Israel. The truth can't stand Israel. So, you know, it's an uphill battle. When you're trying to argue that what we need to do now is debothify the Syrian government and abolish its army. Yeah, doesn't that make a lot of sense to you? Yeah, you know, the Iraq war was great, say all 300 million American people, if only they hadn't debothified the entire government and abolished the army. But that was a big mistake, apparently. Oh, but you know what? That's exactly the policy we should be pursuing in Syria right now. You think 200,000 dead and 5 million refugees is bad? Just wait until the army is dissolved, till the Syrian state no longer exists, and you have just full-scale tribal warfare. Genocide. And anyway. Hey, this is very relevant, because as... Well, I mean, obviously the crisis is still going on, and there's a whole new propaganda push to begin getting involved over there now. As the great Robert Higgs explains about those who push American foreign policies, in the case of Pearl Harbor and virtually everything else that they ever talk about, if they're not outright lying, they always truncate the antecedents. Meaning, they never tell you why things are the way they are, what the U.S. government did to make them the way they are. Just, look, something bad, we better do something to help and fix it. So, more of the background on that on the other side of this break. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Daniel Larrison and Doug Bandow talk about the bad news. Yeah, Siri in a second, but let's talk about white supremacy here for just a second. Now, I wasn't raised Jewish, and in fact, neither was my mom. In fact, I don't think her mom was really raised Jewish either, although I guess more culturally, but my mom's mom was a Jew from Belarus. And you know what that means? That means that me, Horton, the white boy, from the son of an Anglo-American, from the suburbs of Austin, Texas, that means I own the West Bank. It belongs to me. I have the right of return to a place where I've never been, where I'm not from, and by the most tangential, just basically make-believe type rules and regulations, I have a mystical, magical property right, though I've been absentee for 2,000 years, and the people who actually live on the West Bank, they have no right but to lay down and die and get the hell out of my way. Okay? That is white supremacy. And I sit here and oppose it and explain it and teach it to you every day. This is where your money goes. To enforce a system of white supremacy on the people of Palestine. And inside Israel itself, the Ashkenazi lorded over the Mizrahim, and or however you say it, and that means the local Jews from the area with browner skin. And then they lorded over the Muslims and the Christians, and then never even mind the people in the occupied territories who have no rights whatsoever. Even though they believe in Abraham and Moses and I and Yahweh or whatever they call them in their language, and I don't. But I have a right to their land and they don't have a right to their land. Okay, get it? That's white supremacy. Also, it's completely stupid and illegitimate. And anyone who believes in it is just dishonest. I mean, if they said, actually, we're the descendants of Abraham, and we're the ones who were promised all this land, and so now we get to steal all your land and bulldoze all your houses and build a museum of tolerance on top of your ancient cemetery and all of this crap, then you'd call them the Nazis. If the Palestinian Christians and Muslims rounded up all the Jews and put them in an open-air prison, majority, minor population, in the Gaza Strip, and bombed them the way the Israelis bomb the Palestinians there, well, what would happen? America would go to war against the Palestinians to free the Jews from their prison, wouldn't we? So, give me a break. I guess I'm guilty there of the sin of moral equivalence, meaning the same morality that applies to one side applies to the other. Because conservatives, especially Zionists, are above all moral relativists when it comes to the rules applying to them and their team, the way that they apply them to everyone else. All right, now check this out, man. I got a cool new soundbite playing machine here. I don't know what was... don't know why I didn't think of this. I had this one program where it would only show me six at a time or something. And I thought, oh, you know what? I bet I could get a different program for free nowadays. And blam, there it is. So let's listen to some sound bites. Here is the improved audio version of Madeleine Albright.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Isn't that great? Yeah, thank you again to Jeremy for taking all the noise out of that piece. I mean, there's just no good version of that sound by anywhere except this one that Jeremy made.
We think the price is worth it.
Perfect. Took all the buzz, all the hum, all the crackle, everything out of it. Just great. All right, now, here's Biden explaining about what's going on in Syria here.
Our ally.
Oh, that would be the Vice President of the United States of America. Thank you.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, the Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. They were so determined to take down Assad, they poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens of thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda.
Oh, here's part two of that.
We are working hand in glove with the Turks, with the Jordanians, with the Saudis, and with all the people in the region, attempting to identify the people who deserve the help.
Well, that's not part two of the same clip. Thought it was. Anyway.
Well, by identifying those people who are on our side, we can identify who these people are. We can help the right people.
Yeah, we just got to vet them real good here. And, of course, when Biden says et cetera and the other countries in the region, he's talking about Israel. And I was just Googling here. That's why I had a little bit of dead air because it caught me off guard. A Wall Street Journal, Israel, Nusra. And what comes up is Al-Qaeda, a lesser evil? Syria war pulls U.S., Israel apart. And this is all about Israeli support for the al-Nusra Front. Again, sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York. But hey, so what? Because that's in Israel's interests, they think.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
Right, and that's Michael Oren, formerly Benjamin Netanyahu's ambassador to the United States, an American who then went to, he's got dual citizenship, so, or maybe he had to renounce his American citizenship in order to be the Israeli ambassador to America, I don't know. But anyway, there he is saying, from Israel's point of view, we want the Sunnis to win. And this quote, you could tell from the context there, this is from after the fall of Mosul. This is from the very end of last June, maybe early last July, at the Aspen hoity-toity fancy pants conference thing that they do there, 2014. And he's explaining this to Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic. And he's saying, you can hear the reference there, they just shot hundreds of Iraqi, you know, massacred hundreds of Iraqi soldiers in the field. So he's referring to the Islamic State. He's referring to the bin Ladenites who just sacked Mosul and declared not just an Islamic State, but a caliphate. And he's saying, yeah, but at least they're not backed by Iran, which has military nuclear capability, which is, of course, a total lie. And then he blames all the deaths in Syria on Assad when it's, of course, America and Israel and our allies that have been keeping that war going on the other side for the last 4 years straight. Well, 3 years at that time. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. you don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
All right, so that's Hillary Clinton. You always hear every day at the top of the show that clip of her saying, this.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
All right, so that's the first part of the clip. Now, the context there, and I'm sorry, I know it's beating a dead horse, but it's such a great soundbite. I mean, you know. The context there is it's the end of February or very beginning of March 2012. And, of course, the spin, just like today, is why aren't we doing enough against Assad to help the rebels in Syria? And so this is, of course, what she wants to do and actually was doing at the time and was encouraging Obama to do and was, later proclaimed how disappointed she was that he wouldn't go further in the very same policy. But they were pursuing helping the rebels, vetting the rebels, arming and funding the rebels at that time, as were their allies. But her excuse for why aren't we doing more was exactly right. When it was, you know, when the question was put to her in that way, why aren't we doing more? She said, well, you know, it's bin Laden's war over there. Well, his corpse, his number two guy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, it's his war. And so she wasn't saying in that rhetorical question, I'm not trying to put words in her mouth or spin that any worse than what she was actually saying. She wasn't saying, come on now, are we directly arming Zawahiri's men? That wasn't the question. Now, there's been a little bit of that, and I think mostly it's been defections to al-Nusra from the groups that America has supported, but our allies have certainly supported al-Nusra, especially the Turks, this whole time. But that's not exactly what she was saying. She was just saying, if we're supporting the rebellion at all, if we're supporting the moderates in their war against Assad, but they are part of a coalition of rebels that includes Zawahiri's men, then aren't we de facto helping them? Aren't we then fighting a war for our enemies in Al-Qaeda? So maybe we want to be careful and not do that, right? That's her excuse. That's perfectly right. The exact same thing holds today. There are pictures of a young drowned toddler on a beach near Turkey from the massive Syrian refugee crisis that's taking place there. And all the rhetoric is, we've got to stop Assad. America must intervene. Look, a dead toddler. America must begin intervening in Syria now. Not that America and Turkey and Israel and Saudi and Qatar and the UAE and whoever else, Kuwaitis, not that our side, NATO and the GCC, have been backing the rebellion all along. Whoever heard of that? No, we need to begin to back them now. Let's just truncate the antecedents right off the face of the earth here. And go straight to, look, a dead baby, let's go help. Let's go help. Right, because as soon as America's done smashing the secular Ba'athist government there in favor of al-Nusra and the Islamic State, then all the killing will stop. Really? You know, Trevor Tim has a great article about David Petraeus and his idea. Yeah, let's replicate the Anbar Awakening, only without 100,000 troops. And in a situation where the jihadists obviously completely and totally dominate the Sunni-based insurgency here, which is the absolute inverse of the way it was in Iraq in 2007. But then Trevor Tim asks at the end of his article, he says, so, the U.S. arms members of Nusra, they become a powerful fighting force, push back ISIS, and eventually lead a rebellion that overthrows Assad. Well, where are we then? Well, we know U.S. war planners don't usually think that far ahead. Yeah, well, for 10 years straight, we've been thinking that far ahead on this show. Never even mind since the dawn of the Arab Spring and American Saudis attempted hijacking of the, popular uprising in Syria. I've been asking the rhetorical question of experts like Eric Margolies and others on this show for a decade straight. Okay, and if the neocons and the Israelis get their way and get rid of Assad, then what? They destroy his government. They'll get the Muslim Brotherhood, because we're talking about a Sunni majority state here, ruled by a minority dictatorship, right? A coalition secular dictatorship. And so, if we overthrow him in favor of the majority, we get the Muslim Brotherhood if we're lucky. And then everybody to the right of them are the bin Ladenites, the hardcore radical suicide bomber head choppers. So, you don't have to be a genius to just say, oh yeah, then what, then what, then what? Two or three times in a row when it comes to neocon war plans. Now here we are, 10 years into this, 4 years into this particular war, and yeah, then what? ISIS is now in Damascus. If they are actually able, with American help, to overthrow the Ba'athist government, to dissolve that army, and drive Assad out of power, then you have a jihadist war against the Sunnis, the majority of the Sunnis who have backed the government this whole time, plus all the Shia, all the Alawites, all the Christians, three or four different kinds of ancient sects of Christians, and the Druze too. All of them are at risk of annihilation. And the jihadist slogan has been, kill all the sword to all the Shia and the Christians to the sea or something like that. This is crazy. It's the highest treason for our government to be pursuing this policy. And still, because just as Hillary Clinton says, she says, well, Zawahiri has endorsed this war. Well, never mind that. Golani is his loyal servant, okay? Golani, the leader of the al-Nusra Front, has endorsed Zawahiri right back. And has refused to renounce him. And when the Qataris, a few months ago, said they want to rebrand the al-Nusra Front, they want to, like David Petraeus is saying now, they want to rebrand the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda, as the mythical moderates. Never mind the Al-Farouk Brigade and the Northern Storm Brigade and Ahrar al-Sham and the, whatever other so-called mythical moderate groups who are always just as bad as al-Nusra and al-Qaeda anyway, and the Islamic State anyway. Now they want to rebrand al-Nusra itself as the moderates, that is al-Qaeda in Syria. And so they set up an interview, a 40-minute interview, with the head of the al-Nusra Front on Al Jazeera, where he refused. I think the deal was he was supposed to say, yeah, forget Zawahiri. We only have our own little parochial interests in mind, and we don't care about al-Qaeda's war against the West. And he refused to say that. He said, no, of course they're still loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. Nice rebranding, guys. And then they got David Petraeus, who is guilty of material support for terrorism. Marcy Wheeler pointed out, if he was 17 and Muslim saying the things he's saying, he'd be going to prison right now. Here's a man who's on probation right now, who is urging support for al-Qaeda. I know it sounds like conspiracy theory crap, but you can read about it in the Daily Beast. The headline is, Petraeus, use al-Qaeda fighters to beat ISIS. The Daily Beast, that's just Newsweek online. And I know you're saying that's the sloppiest reporting in the world, but no, really, it's, Nancy Youssef. No lie. I mean, if you've been paying attention to the Syria war all along, then you know all this. If you're just tuning in, it sounds like the craziest thing in the whole wide world, and yet there it is. Read Trevor Tim all about it in The Guardian today as well.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. You know, I wish that clip was a little bit longer so that end part was a little louder, you know? I like that song. Maybe I should... I messed around with it trying to pick different 30 seconds out, you know? It's kind of hard to start that in the middle of the verse to where you get the end part loud enough, you know? I don't know. So it's one of those things. Oh, well. The Chaos Show was a long time ago now, wasn't it? All right. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, like I say, Daniel Larrison and Doug Bandow are going to be on the show here in just a little while. But, yeah, you know, I was just reading, well, I don't really know this for a fact, but I was reading a couple of quotes on Twitter here where people who I know them and they're pretty reliable about this. They're talking about the dead baby on the beach in Turkey. Who he is. Well, it turns out he's from a family that fled Kobani. That fled the Islamic State. They weren't the victims of Assad. They were the victims of Assad's enemies. But, oh well, it doesn't matter, right? What difference does it make? Especially if it's going to be a casus belli, it has to be fake, right? Like when the IPG had already rescued the Yazidis from Mount Sinjar a year ago, before that was good enough, even for Reason magazine, to be a fake casus belli for the start of the war against the Islamic State. Same as anything. And, well, look, I mean, hey, it's a picture. A picture says 1,000 words, and especially when the American media is in charge of deciding which words. Doesn't really matter about who was what. And I'm going to play this extended clip of the former head of the DIA again for you, talking about how he personally warned Obama about the rise of the Islamic State, the rise of an Islamic State, as early as 2012 at least. In just a second, but I just wanted to point out this. Dick Cheney has a new book out. He says he was right about Iraq. He was on Fox, and they said, yeah, but people say if Dick Cheney was wrong about Iraq, why should we listen to you on Iran? And he says, I was right about Iraq. And then listen to his answer why he's right about Iraq. This is all he's got. Even with, you know, his daughter Liz sitting on his shoulder, whispering in his ear, telling him all the best things to say, after he's had all this time out of power to come up with a line of crap for us. This is all he's got. Our objective was to take down Saddam Hussein. We did it. Okay, so in other words, I argued that the United States of America would be capable of invading and defeating invading Iraq and defeating its army. Right. I said that, we should have as our objective taking down Saddam, and we did it. So that proves that we could do the thing that I said. Yeah, really? That's a great argument. Yeah, it's, you know, compared to all the billions of humans who thought that America didn't stand a chance against Iraq. Right. They're the massive juggernaut coming our way. The greatest threat to all of mankind. How is America ever supposed to be able to stop them? What with all their nuclear weapons and everything? The world's a much better place without him, he added, didn't explain how that is with the Iranians and their, you know, power drill torturers ruling two-thirds of Iraq, with the Islamic State ruling the other third and having taken over half of Syria, Al-Qaeda in Iraq times 1,000. Al-Qaeda in Iraq that didn't exist until Dick Cheney invaded and overthrew their secular Ba'athist dictatorship there. And then he says, and also, Gaddafi got rid of his centrifuges and weapons designs in 2003. Yeah, I remember that too. I also remember that, and you can read Gary Hart about this in the New York Times Magazine, Gaddafi had been on his knees begging to come in from the cold since 1996. Begging Clinton and Junior, please just, you know, let's warm up relations. 1986 was a long time ago. Please, please, please. And only after the Iraq War, when they had absolutely nothing to show for it whatsoever, did America take him up on his offer and bring him in just because they needed a public relations talking point that, look, the Iraq War scared Gaddafi into compliance. Well, it just wasn't true. And in fact, the only reason he bought that crap from AQ Khan's garage sale was so that he would have it as a chip to bargain to give up to the U.S. so that they would have a talking point and say, look, he gave up his weapons of mass destruction. Well, sorry, cousin. Muammar Gaddafi had nothing but warehouses full of boxes and crates of crap. Leftover junk that the Pakistanis didn't need anymore. No centrifuges spinning whatsoever. And he wasn't scared from the Iraq War into doing it either. He'd been on his knees begging since the days when Bill Clinton was elected versus Bob Dole. And then he says, and then we went after AQ Khan. That was his achievement. Then he says, so we achieved a lot in Iraq. That was it. So that's his conclusion. So we achieved a lot. We were able to get rid of Saddam, and the world's a much better place without him, as long as you don't look at what kind of place the world is without him. And how Al-Qaeda went from 200 men, or probably 80 by the time the Air Force and the CIA were done with him in Afghanistan, to now, what, I don't know, 8,000 men? Or 80,000 if you include all the foot soldiers of the Islamic State. Gaddafi came in from the cold, as he'd been begging to anyway, and they decided to finally go after AQ Khan, who, guess what, guys? I know you're going to be shocked. The CIA knew that he stole centrifuge plans from the Urenco company in Europe, what, in Sweden or the Netherlands or whatever, in the 1970s. And they watched all along, turned a blind eye deliberately throughout the entire Reagan years as AQ Khan helped build the Pakistani nuclear weapons program, as long as they were helping America and Saudi back the Mujahideen against the commies in the 1980s. They could have wrapped up AQ Khan at any point. From when did he originally steal the plans from Urenco? I'm trying to remember. It was like 1977 or something. And they knew what he was doing the entire time. So this is supposedly, this is Dick Cheney's best case for the Iraq War. It proved that the U.S. Army was able to invade Iraq. Huh, yeah, when the supermajority of the population was against Saddam and sat back and allowed the invasion and didn't resist it at all at the time that it happened, too. So, wow, huge. Much better place without him, as long as you don't actually examine any of the consequences of that war. Because there are no good consequences of that war, other than, you know, him personally being lynched, which he deserved. But the consequences of that lynching. Remember, what did they all shout as they lynched Saddam Hussein? You remember? Muqtada, Muqtada, Muqtada! Yeah. America as the sock puppet of the United Iraqi Alliance, not the other way around. And then, yeah, a bunch of nothing. So anyway, I just thought that was funny, that that was actually the best case that Dick Cheney could make. Gaddafi. And then what do they do to Gaddafi? They turn around and stabbed him right in the back, which Doug Bandow's about to explain is just goes to show why the North Koreans will never give up their nukes now. Not after what America did to Gaddafi. Give up the vestiges of a nuclear program. We promise it'll be cool. We'll bring in from the cold. And then they bombed him to death.
We came... We saw he died.
Yep. And now the place is ruled by a bunch of warring lunatics, including a group calling themselves the Islamic State. Led by, guess who? Abdul Hakim. No, I'm confusing him with a different guy. It's Abdel Bel Hodge. What's his middle name again? Bel Hodge is his last name. And he's the guy who used to work for Osama and then Zarqawi. And then Obama. And apparently now Baghdadi. How you like that? All right. And then here, Flynn. Oh, I don't have time to play the Flynn clip now. Oh, you know what? I will later, though, because Doug Bandow is only going to be able to do one segment on the show today. So I will have time to play the Flynn clip for you. I forgot that. That was on my... What do I want to do there? I will play that for you. And then also, there's a huge list of people gunned down by the cops, shot to death, murdered, killed by the cops lately. Some of them on video, some of them not. All of them completely ridiculous. To put the nicest spin on it, so we're going to talk some about that too. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Daniel Larrison. He's holding down the foreign policy over there at the American Conservative magazine, theamericanconservative.com. And just a few days ago, this one was the spotlight at antiwar.com. You could find it in our viewpoint section there if you need to. Who's war in Yemen? And that's a play on a famous American Conservative magazine article from the past. But anyway, we'll skip that. Or maybe we'll come back to it. Who's war in Yemen? Saudi Arabia wreaks havoc on its poorest neighbor with U.S. help. Welcome back to the show, Daniel. How are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
Good, good. Yeah, I'm very happy to have you here. And I just got to tell you, I really appreciate you paying attention to this story. As you know, so few are. It's just there's so many other news stories. A war on Yemen, a country most Americans couldn't find on a map kind of thing. It's just, since America's not in the lead on the war, it's just barely even making the headlines at all. And so I'm kind of sorry to do this to you, but I think you'll understand. Could you please help make up for that by giving us, you know, the bare bones, explaining what is this war before we get into the real nitty-gritty?
Sure. So the basic facts are 5 months ago, a little over 5 months ago, Saudi Arabia and a coalition of mostly Gulf states, but also Egypt, Sudan, and a few other Arab states from around the world have joined forces to attack Yemen with the goal of driving back this militia from North Yemen, this Zaydi Shiite militia known popularly as the Houthis, also known as Ansar Allah, which has been in opposition to successive Yemeni governments over the last 10, 15 years, really 20 years, to be more precise. And so this group had effectively deposed and driven out the president that succeeded the old dictator who stepped down in 2012. The current exiled president, Hadi, then with the backing of the Saudis, has tried to drive the Houthis back out of the south of Yemen. The Saudis and Emiratis have managed to do that with their own ground forces after pummeling and battering the country with bombing for 5 months. The Saudis have committed numerous war crimes that have been documented by Human Rights Watch and other organizations. They have been maintaining a blockade that is depriving the country of necessary foodstuffs, medicine, fuel, and has brought an already poor and poverty-stricken country to the brink of famine. And in all of this, the U.S. has been providing logistics and intelligence support and, of course, has sold the Saudis the weapons that they're using to batter Yemen as we speak.
All right, now
all of this has been driven by this. Just one more thing.
Sure.
All of this has been driven by the Saudis' paranoid fear of anything to do with Iran, and they have imagined or exaggerated the Iranian role in Yemen, and now think that they're striking a blow against Iranian interests by doing this. And that's basically propaganda and nonsense.
Right. Okay. Now, very many points to go over there, and thank you for that. I think that's, you know, a pretty damn good thumbnail there for people just catching up on this. But so the most important thing to me, well, they're competing, I guess, the humanitarian crisis, but I guess more newsworthy in a way to Americans, the U.S. role in this. You say helping with logistics, and there's a famous Wall Street Journal article from a few months ago now, describing a little bit of that. But I wonder if you can help us, especially with sourcing, on just exactly what role the Americans are playing here. It's difficult to imagine the Saudis running their own air traffic control for this war. I just assume it must be American AWACS in the air and ships at sea are basically running the entire war for them. But am I assuming too much? Do you know?
There are ships are certainly involved in the blockade. We're certainly helping them with in-air refueling, and we have people at bases in Saudi Arabia that are helping them to select targets. So the U.S. is very much directly involved in the prosecution of the war, even though we don't have people dropping bombs or necessarily operating inside Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
But there's certainly close cooperation between the U.S. military and the Saudis.
Mm-hmm. And now, as far as day-to-day, hour-to-hour air traffic control, do you know about that? Or does anyone?
I'm not sure about that. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah. I mean, I've looked around, and I can't find any real good reporting about this. Even where the L.A. Times said we're sending more guys over there, there's still a real lack of detail about what exactly they're doing, if they're just picking targets out on a map or whether they're really running the war, which is, I just assume that they must be, because I've never read anything about the Saudis that would make me believe that they have the ability to run air traffic control for a war like this. But then again, would the Americans be picking this many civilian targets to destroy? Maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's clear that they're not ruling them out, or they're not keeping the Saudis from selecting them. Because there is pretty clear evidence that the Saudis are deliberately targeting civilian areas, especially in the north of Yemen, where the Houthis have their stronghold. The Saudis have been targeting the areas that are strictly civilian in nature, and declared the entire city of Sada a military target in violation of international law.
Mm.
So the Saudis certainly have no compunction about that, and whatever the U.S. role is in that, well, we're not restraining them from doing that. That's clear.
Man, yeah, you know, Matthew Akins was on the show a few weeks back, and he talked about, he saw it with his own eyes, where they were just bombing, I think he said hotels, certainly a car dealership, and all different civilian infrastructure where there were no enemies anywhere around, but just, you know, families being destroyed hither and yon.
Right. He's a reporter for Rolling Stone. He's done really great work on this story. And as he said, he smuggled himself into Yemen, which is what journalists have to do in order to get access to the on-the-ground conditions, because the Saudis are very closely restricting the flow of information in and out of Yemen. And of course, they're restricting movement of people. That's one of the side effects of the blockade, one of the goals of the blockade is to keep information from getting out. And that's one of the reasons why the coverage of the war is so scanty and so sort of sporadic, because there's simply very few ways to get in safely. So the journalists are discouraged from even trying.
All right. Now, another thing that it seems to be reported kind of often, but still without much detail, is the humanitarian crisis there. I mean, it's been said for months and months that under this blockade. These people are destined to starve. They import 90% of their food, plus the war has completely destroyed their infrastructure for distribution of whatever crops are being harvested and things like that. There's no fuel for trucks. I mean, but then how many have already starved to death? A human being can only go for so long without food and fresh water to drink, Daniel. Does anybody know?
No, I know. I don't think there are good sources on exact numbers of how many people are perishing. Of course, in addition to the food shortages, you have the outbreaks of malaria and dengue fever that have become much worse because of poor sanitary conditions, because of the lack of access to clean water. So the fatalities from those diseases and obviously from malnutrition are much higher than they would otherwise be. But unfortunately, we don't know exactly how many. The warnings coming from aid organizations, though, are that millions of people are at risk, at extreme risk of starvation. I believe one of the most recent estimates put it at 6 million are at the most critical stage of lacking food, and another 7 million beyond that are also severely deprived. Almost the entire country is lacking in basic necessities, again, because of the blockade.
Well, and all you have to do is just look to America's war across the strait there in Yemen and during the famine there, where more than half a million people starved to death in 2011. And, of course, more than half of those were children under the ages of 5 years old. That's who, you know, can afford least to go without food and water. That's who we're at war against here, are innocent babies. Who couldn't possibly have done anything to anybody at this point in their life to deserve any kind of assault like this. It's just, anyway, hold it right there, y'all. We'll be right back with the great Daniel Larrison from the American Conservative in 1 sec.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Daniel Larrison from the American Conservative Magazine about this article, Who's War in Yemen? You know, to go slightly off topic for a minute, I think it's important, y'all. I think you understand why it's so important to have journalism like this, opinion writing like this from the right. You don't have to be some big fat millionaire communist hypocrite like Michael Moore to be for peace. And whoever told you that was a liar. And it's very important that you can show people conservative arguments against this empire. And Daniel Larrison, he's got his facts straight on just what's going on, obviously. And he's got the conservative reasons why it does not have to be this way, why it should not be this way. And so, you know, that's the best way to get through to your right wing family, friends, whoever it is you're trying to influence, is attack them from the right. And show them what utopian world revolutionaries they are and embarrass them into being a peacenik. Basically, that's my plan. Anyway, so, Daniel, where we left off here, I forget, we were talking about the people all starving to death. Is anybody doing anything about this? I know that there have been some half-hearted attempts at peace talks in the past, but is anybody really trying to force America, to force the Saudis to come to terms to end this thing short of some kind of total victory, which could be, you know, months or years and you know, maybe millions of lives from now?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think there has been much progress along those lines. There have been informal talks by the U.S. with various parties, including Oman, which has tried to act as a mediator in this conflict prior to now. There have been some efforts by the U.N. to try to get the competing Yemeni factions to sit down with one another. But after the last talks in Europe broke down, there really hasn't been anything significant along those lines since then. There have been a couple so-called humanitarian pauses, but those pauses, to the extent they were even honored, were just short respites that didn't really address the main humanitarian problems. So, unfortunately, there hasn't been much progress made in that. And because the Saudis and Emiratis have started to make up ground in South Yemen, they are now talking about a full-out assault on the capital in the fall in the hopes of finally displacing the Houthis from the capital. That even if that were to happen, the civilian toll in the capital would be incredibly horrific. And so we have to hope that there is more pressure placed on them between now and then so that they don't actually launch that offensive. Unfortunately, with the Saudi king coming to Washington this week, there doesn't seem to be much indication that Obama is going to try to press him on that. There was some very weak rhetoric coming from the White House ahead of the visit this week, saying that there will be a need to end the fighting and the importance of enduring that assistance can reach Yemenis on all sides of the conflict, which, of course, sounds good. But if the U.S. were in earnest about that, it wouldn't be facilitating the war. It wouldn't be helping with the blockade. So it's a little hard to take seriously that the U.S. is even interested in imposing that pressure. And the Saudis seem really hell-bent on this. It's part of their new, more aggressive foreign policy doctrine overall. And so I'm not sure how much the U.S. could actually rein them in now that they've got their forces in Yemen.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like Obama could tell him, look, I'm just turning this thing off, man. No more American help. No more American CIA or military help any pick targets or run the war anymore. But then, I don't know, maybe they would say, that's fine. We got enough of your money and equipment and our guys trained by yours that we can make do without you. You know, sounds like maybe that's what they're afraid is going to happen here. So they have to go ahead and keep helping them anyway. Don't lose that influence that they apparently don't have.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the Saudi king, of course, is coming here to ask for even more assistance. So I think the best we can hope for from Obama is that he doesn't at least give them anything more than he's already done. But I wouldn't have guessed that the U.S. would be as involved as it is. And so it's entirely possible that the U.S. will get sucked even more deeply into this conflict before it's all over.
Yeah, but Daniel, Iran, they're taking over the planet, et cetera, et cetera. What about that?
Well, I mean, of course, the Iranian influence has been exaggerated from the start. And really, all the Iranians have to do is sit back and watch as the Saudis and their allies waste their resources in this conflict. Iran isn't being harmed in the least by this. They don't provide the Houthis with much aid. The Houthis don't do anything for them. So really, if they're, even though they're the nominal target of all of this, there's really nothing that they can lose as a result of this conflict. So if you were worried about Iranian influence, or if you were interested in actually checking Iranian influence, Yemen is the worst place to go. And of course, Yemenis shouldn't be punished in any case for whatever sins the Iranian government may or may not have committed. But unfortunately, they're the ones that are getting it in the net.
Yeah. Well, it seems like the thing that Iran has most to do with it, even Obama himself admitted that they warned the Houthis not to take Sana'a, that would be biting off more than they could chew and would lead to adverse consequences and all that. It seems like, if anything, the Iranian role is they're the excuse for this, basically. And they're why Obama has to let them do it is because, so you'll not bankroll too much effort to ruin the Iran deal in the U.S.
Right, which becomes less of an excuse every day. I'm not sure that the Saudis could have actually stopped the deal even if they had been fully publicly invested against it. And now that the votes are there to prevent a veto override of the resolution, I don't see what Saudi opposition could do to it at this point. So really, there are no more even semi-plausible excuses for why the U.S. is helping.
Now, I don't know, you know, what's your experience in, you know, military strategy and this, that, and the other thing, but is it predictable that at some point, if they keep this up, like, say, the Libya war 2011, we were all against it, but we could see the writing on the wall that at some point they're going to corner Gaddafi and kill him and replace him here, or at least get rid of him. I don't know about replace him, but I wonder if you think that it's just a matter of time before actually, yeah, the Houthis are driven out of Sana'a and Hadi is put back on the throne there. Or I don't know. It sort of seemed like the Houthis haven't been losing so far as much as they've been being attacked.
Well, they may eventually be driven out of the capital. Although in order to do that, the capital will probably be reduced to ruins in the process. So I'm not sure how any government that succeeds them will be able to govern in any case. But I think Hadi personally will not be able to retain power, even if they try to reinstall him, because he is so widely hated in the capital and in the north because of his role in supporting this campaign. That and the people in the South Yemen have no particular love for him either. He simply became the convenient figurehead because he's technically the president, therefore they can claim to be on his side. But there really is no constituency for him, and that's one of the reasons why he was booted out of power so easily in the first place. He was the default consensus figure to take over from Saleh after the protests in 2011. So even if the Houthis are removed from the capital, they still have their redoubt in the north, and I don't think the Saudis would be, well, I don't know, but they would be crazy to try to go after them up there. And Hadi is not going to be president again. I would be pretty confident about that.
Hmm. Oh, well, at least the silver lining is, though, that AQAP has been destroyed, right, Daniel?
Well, unfortunately, they're getting stronger by the day. As the Saudis and Emiratis have advanced in the south, so has al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They have seized parts of Aden now, and, of course, they already controlled Mukalla farther east in South Yemen. So they're getting many new footholds all over the country thanks to this. And one of the less reported stories, in this very underreported story, is that a branch of the Islamic State, so-called Islamic State, has started acting against Shiite targets in Yemen and just bombed a mosque in Sana'a just the other day, killing some 30 people, I think. So jihadists are the main ones benefiting from all of this at the expense of Yemeni's lives and the security of the whole region.
Yeah, just what we need is IS and al-Qaeda in competition in Yemen. Just great. All right, well, listen, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your writing about this regularly as you do and as well as you do and your time again shared with us on the show today, Daniel. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Scott. Glad to be back.
All right, y'all. That's Daniel Larrison. Who's war in Yemen? Saudi Arabia wreaks havoc on its poorest neighbor with U.S. help. That's at theamericanconservative.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org. LibertyRadioNetwork.com. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Follow me on there if you want. I might hurt your feelings, though. Anyway, next up, our friend Doug Bandow. He's from the Cato Institute. He also writes for Forbes and for the National Interest at nationalinterest.org. And, well, first of all, welcome to the show, Doug. How you doing?
Happy to be on. How are you?
I'm doing real good. I appreciate you joining us here again today. Now, I wanted to interview you about this one in the national interest. Thanks to Libya, North Korea might never negotiate on nuclear weapons. But you know what? I already explained it to everybody earlier in the show what the article's about. And now that I found this, I'm more interested in this one I haven't read yet. How China and the United States can learn to get along. Tell them, Doug. Tell me.
Well, both countries have to, you know, recognize, I think, most importantly, that war would be really, really stupid, that there's nothing kind of between the two countries that makes that worthwhile. And that's something, especially for the United States, which wants to dominate East Asia, I think has to be willing to step back and recognize you got to give China some space.
All right, but now, come on, the right-wing hawks are going to say, yeah, but what you're saying is let the Chinese run roughshod over all their neighbors and steal all their resources in the sea near there and this, that, and the other thing. And all of, like Cheney's new book, all this Obama leading from behind has led to the re-rise of China, challenging Vietnam and Korea and Japan and the Philippines for their possessions.
Yeah, yeah, it really is wonderful to have a good old Dick Cheney out there, you know, telling us what to do. Yeah, it's frustrating. You know, what's amazing is that these folks on the right who domestically talk about, you know, responsibility and incentives and, you know, don't believe in, you know, kind of social engineering. When it comes to, you know, everything overseas, you know, nobody can do anything. Everything has to be America. You can't expect people to take care of themselves. And what we see going on in East Asia is these countries recognize that China's being a little pushy, and they're responding. I mean, a lot of folks over there are building submarines, and thankfully, they're actually not building them because of America. They're building them because of China. You know, countries are working together. The Philippines actually wants Japan to do more. India, you know, is showing up with its navy in the, you know, kind of the South China Sea sort of area. It's, you know, doing training with Vietnam. So these are good things which we should encourage, as opposed to think that we have to step in there and try to do everything for everyone.
Yeah. Now, well, so part of the thing about China is people are afraid of China. It's a billion people. It's a pseudo sort of kind of communist dictatorship. And I'm trying to remember what old funny novel I read, whether it's some Tom Robbins or Kurt Vonnegut. Maybe it was Kurt Vonnegut talking about how nobody knows what's going on over there. So everybody just assumes that they're building a, you know, 50 million man army to conquer the whole world and this kind of thing. Now, that was back more in Mao days, I guess. But the point being is that China is a great boogeyman. You know, unlike Al-Qaeda, which is still only a couple of thousand guys, at least China is a real place, and they got H-bombs and stuff, right? So, you know, I don't know. I wonder, though, whether you think that, you know, their power at this stage in the 21st century is all that it's cracked up to be in the PR.
Well, look, they're a long way from being a great power. Now, this is a country that over the long term is going to be very important. You know, and what we kind of talk about, you know, the way people talk about it, it could be a peer competitor of the United States. That is, it could be America's equal. It could be out there and also have a globe-spanning military. But it ain't there yet. I mean, this is a country that remains quite poor. You know, that you know, it's a big economy, but it's, you know, you have to divide that by all the people. You get outside of Beijing, Shanghai, you know, the other big cities, you know, there's still a lot of poverty. Now, this is, we see the economic problems they're going through. I mean, no one believes their numbers. Everyone believes they're growing, but not as fast as they've claimed. They have all sorts of internal political issues. So it's really silly for the United States, which is this enormous power, to be kind of cowering in the corner, worried about what the Chinese are doing. You know, the best thing we can do is to kind of get our own economy in order. The best thing we can do is to work well with other countries and expect them to take care of themselves and to deal with potential threats down the line. And we also have to, you know, not be stupid. That is, we would not allow another country forever to kind of dominate us along our border. We're not going to be able to do that along with China. So we have to be willing to step back. Well, what's vital for America and what's not, trying to dominate China along its border is not, you know, vital for us.
Yeah. Well, and you know, what's funny here too is from the whole Cheney view, everything is, you know, from the eyes from the bridge of an aircraft carrier or something. But if there are real disputes in in the sea over there over who owns what mineral rights. Well, if America was, you know, temporary limited constitutional republic, a normal country in a normal time, then we might have a pretty nice role there to host peace talks where these guys can negotiate these issues. Maybe they can create some international consortiums to exploit these resources in harmony together or whatever. Why not? There's no reason any of this has to be a zero-sum game anyway, other than the American empire is the one over there lording it over everyone.
No, that's right. There are a lot of alternatives for them. You know, they can kind of do joint research development. They can put, you know, sovereignty aside. And you're right. At this stage, it's very hard for us to act as if, you know, we, you know, in some sense, are, you know, not partisans, not biased. I mean, the point is we're part of this. Our allies are involved. We promise to protect our allies. You know, the Chinese correctly say, you know, you guys are part of this. You know, there's no, and we have that same problem, of course, in the Middle East and elsewhere, that no one looks at us as being disinterested. If we actually were, we could play a much more effective role, I think, in terms of promoting peace.
Yeah. All right, now listen, there's just no escaping the fact that a huge part of the excitement behind Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump both are that they seem to be powerful enough. One a senator, the other a billionaire. They're of high enough rank in our society that they, you know, conceivably actually could win, and they're willing to say what apparently huge portions of the American people have been thinking all this time, and that the establishment centrist, you know, liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats that run this country have been unwilling to really even discuss this whole time, and that is free trade and immigration. And these guys both say shut it down and especially fear the Chinese and use the law to prevent the Chinese from competing with us. Look what they've done to our entire economy. They imported all these Hispanics we can't understand, and they shipped all our factory jobs away. And so what do you have to say to them?
Well, look, there's a, I mean, it's easy to demonize foreigners. Unfortunately, that's been something we've done historically. You know, most we are foreigners come here to work. I mean, Donald Trump's simply wrong on the crime issue. Actually, native-born Americans are more likely to commit crimes than foreigners are. I mean, you know, if you have somebody who comes over, you know, we should throw them out if they commit a crime, obviously. You know, there's some important issues here in terms of welfare benefits and other stuff that are quite, you know, reasonable to talk about. It doesn't make sense to kind of do this demonization. Of course, what's interesting about Trump, excuse me, is that in talking about China, he's talked about the economics. He hasn't suggested we should go to war with them. You know, so if you look at what other Republicans have said, it's actually worse. I mean, he's the bombastic one. But on this issue, I mean, he focuses on trade with China. It's the other guys who are talking much more in military terms. And I think that if you look at both these guys, it's not just those issues. I think it's a broader sense that the establishment has failed. You know, Americans are very frustrated. They have this kind of one party, you know, and it's foreign intervention, it's big spending, it's kind of corporate welfare. Republicans and Democrats alike kind of glom onto this status system. Both of these guys, I mean, are certainly no free-flowing libertarians from my standpoint, but both of them are attacking pieces of this. Where you look at Hillary Clinton, well, she's as much a corporate welfare person as any Republican. You know, you look at kind of how the establishment runs things, you understand the frustration.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, but so what about the idea, though, that, you know, when our government signs these free trade agreements that, hey, it's a race to the global bottom. And guess what? The global bottom is a penny per hour. And American laborers can't compete with that. And so they live like shit, Doug. They wait tables where they used to have a good job. And so government's got to do something about it. What about that?
Well, the problem with that, of course, is that productivity is what determines pay. And American workers are among the most productive on earth. You know, American corporations aren't going to put their factories in a place that has no, you know, a legal kind of system that has no protection of property, in which workers don't know anything, in which everything's dangerous. You know, do you want to put your factory in the middle of Pakistan? Go ahead. What are you going to get out of it? Indonesia, a lot of other countries. So, in fact, American jobs haven't been disappearing like that. American workers are more productive. What's happening is we simply produce more stuff with fewer workers. Our challenge is to create other work out there. Every country is losing manufacturing jobs, even China. We need to be better domestically at freeing up people to create jobs rather than putting burdens on them in terms of trying to create them. And that's really where I think especially somebody like Bernie Sanders would fall down. He's going to have much more regulation. It's going to make it actually harder to create jobs here. So, yeah, we'll have fewer jobs, not because of trade, but because of this other stuff.
Yeah. Well, and this is the same old song from the libertarian point of view. It's just watching the same slow motion train wreck over and over and over again where Every government intervention creates new problems that, quote-unquote, necessitate further intervention and on down
the chain we go.
Exactly
right.
Whether we're talking about wars or war on poverty or anything else. But listen, I know you got to go, so I'll just thank you for coming back on the show, Doug. It's great to talk to you as always.
Hey, happy to be on. Take care of yourself.
All right, y'all. That's Doug Bandow. He's at Cato, he's at Forbes, and he's at the National Interest. This one is called How China and the United States Can Learn to Get Along. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Superior blends of premium coffee, roasted fresh in Zionsville, Indiana. Darren's Coffee satisfies the casual and the connoisseur. Scott Horton Show listeners, visit darrenscoffee.com and use the coupon code Scott at checkout for free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. That was Doug Bandow. He could only do one segment today, which is unfortunate, but that was a pretty good interview. And that's okay, too, because I needed this time to talk about some more things and play for you this clip, I promise. You know, with the interviews, sometimes we got to stop and skip around and come back to a subject. But here is, and yes, it's edited, and I'll tell you now, it's not really edited for deception, just for time purposes. And what's edited out is a bunch of crap about why I said we should support the mythical moderates. But I don't think that really changes the context of the clip. And otherwise, it's just mostly edited for us and stuff like that. But this is a guy named Mehdi Hassan from Al Jazeera, and he's interviewing Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who is a hawk, who wants full war against the Islamic State and a much more hawkish policy of some kind or another against Iran, too. So it's not like he's some, you know, peacenik or something like that, but he's just, there are differences in America's Syria policy, believe it. And so here he is being confronted by Mehdi Hassan about the DIA document that was leaked that showed that DIA was concerned in August of 2012 that if the U.S., well, that the U.S. and its allies' support for the Sunni-based insurgency in Syria could lead to the rise of an Islamic State in eastern Syria and then, dangerously, possibly even Iraq, which then, of course, is exactly what happened and is, of course, exactly what we were warning on that show, probably on that very same day, too, on this show, that very same day, too. So anyway, here is Flynn confronted about it and confirming it all for you.
And a secret analysis by the agency you ran, the Defense Intelligence Agency, in August 2012 said, and I quote, there is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist, it's not secret anymore, it was released under FOI. The quote is, there is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria, and this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime. The U.S. saw the ISIL caliphate coming and did nothing. Did you see this document in 2012? Was this come across your table?
Yeah. I paid very close attention to all this.
So when you saw this, did you not pick up a phone and saying, what on earth are we doing supporting these Syrian rebels?
That kind of information is presented and
what did you
do about it? I argued about it.
Did you say we shouldn't be supporting these groups?
I did. I mean, we argued about the different groups that were there, and we said, you know, who is it that is involved here? And I will tell you that I do believe that the intelligence was very clear. And now it's a matter of whether or not policy is going to be as clear and as defining and as precise as it needs to be. And I don't believe it was.
But in 2012, 3 years ago, let's just be clear, for the sake of our viewers. In 2012, your agency was saying, quote, the Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda in Iraq are the major forces driving the insurgency in Syria. Mm-hmm. In 2012, the U.S. was helping coordinate arms transfers to those same groups. Why did you not stop that if you're worried about the rise of, quote-unquote, Islamic extremism?
I mean, I hate to say it's not my job, but my job was to ensure that the accuracy of our intelligence that was being presented was as good as it could be. And I will tell you, it goes before 2012. I mean, when we were in Iraq, and we still had decisions to be made before there was a decision to pull out of Iraq in 2011. I mean, it was very clear what we were going to face.
Well, I admire your frankness
very
on this
clear
subject.
What we were going to
let
face.
Let me just, take one before we move on, just to clarify once more. You are basically saying that even in government at the time, you knew those groups were around, you saw this analysis,
sure.
And you were arguing against it. But who wasn't listening?
I think the administration.
So the administration turned a blind eye to your analysis?
I don't know if they turned a blind eye. I think it was a decision. I think it was a willful decision.
A willful decision to go support an insurgency that had Salafists, Al-Qaeda, and Muslim Brotherhood.
A willful decision to do what they're doing, which you have to really, ask the president, what is it that he actually is doing with the policy that is in place? Because it is very, very confusing. I'm sitting here today, Matty, and I can't tell you exactly what that is. And I've been at this for a long time.
All right. There you go. Keep that in mind if you can. All right. Now, just catch up a few things here. Sanders, I wouldn't end the drone program. No, of course not. And the drone program means what? Means bombing Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, and now Syria, too. This was one of the top stories I didn't get to yesterday, announcing the new CIA drone war against the Islamic State in Syria. Getting the Reaper sales back up there. Sanders, oh, I wouldn't end the drone war. Gotta have drone wars and this and that kind of thing. I'm on board for the National Security State. You can trust me, National Security State, he says. And then at the World Socialist website, Bernie Sanders, silent partner of American militarism, by Patrick Martin. And I would have run this article at antiwar.com except for the last stupid paragraph where he says, oh, this guy's into capitalism. Come on. Anyway, too bad about that. I mean, he could have said modern American state capitalism and I would have been perfectly fine with it. Just a little too oversimplification-ness from you there, Patrick. But anyway, you all ought to read this, because here's a real-ass commie basically saying, let me tell you about Bernie Sanders, all right? Let's count all the wars he's in favor of. Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Now, he was good on Iraq 02, 03. So give him that. He was good on Libya, but only because he thought it should be congressionally authorized. That was the only part of it he complained about, was that the president didn't go to the Congress. He didn't really have much to say other than that. And then here he is again. You got to include Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia in the drone war that he supports. Oh, and he's bad on Ukraine and said, oh yeah, we got to stand up to Russian aggression and all this in Ukraine too. There's Bernie Sanders. There's your hope and change for you. You know, I don't know. It was funny, man. This guy in my Twitter mentions this morning. At first I thought he was being naive, but then I think I remembered him from before. And he's going, no, you gotta play the game. You gotta do the thing. All the Obama apologists, all the Rand Paul apologists, all the Bernie Sanders apologists, they all say the same thing. Wait, am I an idiot? I got duped. I believe in somebody who actually is not good enough to believe in? That can't be the explanation. So it must be that there's a secret Bernie Sanders in there that actually isn't as bad as he's pretending to be. There's a secret Rand Paul in there that's actually agrees with me on everything. Just wait until he has total power. Then he'll reveal himself to actually be an angel. That's what they all tell themselves. It's the very same thing. Guess what? You don't have to believe in any politician at all. Ain't you ever seen Brewster's Millions, man? None of the above. You don't have to believe in them. What if George Carlin was here? What would George Carlin say to you? Oh, yes, you have to believe in either this guy or this guy. Is that what he would say to you? Or he would smack you on the back of the head and say, wise up. The state is your enemy. And I'm sorry, because I know it is a bummer of a deal that, no, you don't get to have a president that is not a damn devil. You don't get to. That can be upsetting sometimes, I understand, but, you know, it is what it is. All right. And this, you know, this isn't really my issue, but people are interested in what's the libertarian take on things sometimes. So, there's this lady, Kim Davis, from Kentucky, who works for the local whatever bureaucracy, who's in charge of giving marriage licenses. And the courts have ruled that you can't discriminate. You've got to give marriage licenses to homosexual couples, too. And she's taking a stand on her religious freedom that she doesn't have to. Well, okay, so here's the libertarian take on this. First of all, government shouldn't be involved in marriage at all. But as long as it is, government should not discriminate over who they recognize. Should be up to the private party whether they're getting married or not. And if the government has to put a rubber stamp on it, then fine. But they shouldn't be able to discriminate and pick and choose. Also, this lady has the right to believe whatever she wants. And if the God and the Jesus that she believes in just absolutely would not approve of her participating in this, then that's perfectly legitimate for her to believe that. That's one of the highest priorities of all Americans, is that all of us have the right to believe whatever we want, man. Fine. But you don't have the right to be a government employee. So if you don't want to implement the policy under the law, then resign. That's it. Then a judge comes and puts the lady in jail. Puts her in jail. You know, just remove her from her office. She doesn't have the right to be a government employee. Why is this a question? Why isn't everyone in the world a libertarian on every issue? I just don't understand it. Every left-wing and right-wing approach to everything is so damn dumb. But anyway, tonight, me and Hornberger. Oh, I'm sorry I didn't get to talk about all the killer cops. Lots of killer cops. Look at Twitter. Tonight, me and Hornberger, 8 o'clock Eastern, for the future freedom at liberty.me.